my great pleasure to be here again. It's particularly nice to visit this area in winter time. We already have snow away in Cambridge.
Don't tell that to Simple.
Okay, so I'd like to emphasize that two of my graduate students, Philip Singer and Owen Hunt, worked incredibly hard. Actually, it's amazing that none of my graduate students have quit my group, even though they are forced to work kind of continuously. So Philip and Owen made an enormous contribution to this work. Now, at the beginning of my talk, I have a short segment in which we will present a very new result, actually very brand new. So we believe that there is certain kind of short wave scale that determines the electric states of coupled with one. Namely, in the past 10 years, everybody, including ourselves, assumes that if you dope holes, suppose you dope strontium, and strontium donates hole, and then once hole is donated into coupled point, it goes anywhere and it's homogeneous. But I now suspect that that's not really true. So we will talk about this issue first. Then the second part, the longer one, is about stripes. Basically, we have two sets of conclusions. One is, if you look at all kinds of experimental results, experiments point towards the conclusion that slowing of charge dynamics are the key to cause what people now call stripes behavior, which originally was considered spinless until the experimental discovery of stripe in 1995. The second part is we believe that motional effect is important even in the 1/8 slope phase, even at 350 mK. In other words, at NMR time scale, even at 350 mK, we don't really see periodic modulation of spin and charge. It's highly disordered entity. So this is highly sophisticated audience, but let me start with the introduction of what nuclear quadrupole resonance is. So this doesn't really show everything. So what we observe is kappa nuclear spin, which is spins to be hard. Because of that, kappa has nuclear quadrupole moment, and nuclear quadrupole moment has interaction with surrounding environment through nuclear quadrupole interaction, through the second derivative of Coulomb potential. So quadrupole moment is surrounded by amplitude shell in x squared minus y scale orbital that creates electric gradient. But also there's oxygen 2 minus ion here, lanthanum 3 plus ion there, strontium 2 plus ion there, and so forth. Everything is added up. And then the summation of the second derivative of Coulomb potential is proportional to the quadrupole resonance frequency, which is the splitting of this degenerate nuclear levels. So you can sense charge environment, lattice environment, by observing this resonance. Now, there are primarily three components that are important. One is lattice effect. Second is the presence of hole. And also, it's very difficult to theoretically reproduce quadrupole resonance frequency by first principle calculations, because there is a so-called undershooting by core electrons. So if you produce some field gradient away from this copper site, but there is undershooting by a deformation of the core electrons. So it's very difficult to reproduce quadrupole copper. However, for ocean side, first principles calculations work quite well. On the other hand, for copper side, it doesn't work at all because of coercion there. Now,
I mean, you're saying that the copper core behaves anomalously? Is that what you're saying?
Well, not necessarily just core, but basically electrons on copper side behaves in a way that is not expected in conventional bound calculation, type calculation.
So people did calculations for oxygen, I know these calculations exist, and it also...
Yeah, so they did calculations on oxygen, it works, but for copper it doesn't. Now here is a typical result of nuclear quadrupole resonance spectrum. For 214 compounds, green blossom took up 4, red is 2%, strontium doping, blue is 7.5, black is 15%. Now, there are several features you should realize. First of all, peak frequency systematically moves away, and also line broadens tremendously once small amount of doping is made. And also there is small hump or B line once you dope strontium ions or barium ions. But this is actually not interesting part. Basically, this integrated intensity of B line is exactly proportional to the doping amount. So the consensus in the community is basically if you replace 3 plus ion by 2 plus ion, instead of affecting nearest neighbor sites, actually somehow the effect goes to this side. And so if you have 15% doping here, 2 plus instead of 3 plus, that creates different electrical gradient. Perhaps because of the axial symmetry of this side, that affects this side most. And this signal is observable even at high temperatures, so this is not from phase separation or something fast, it's just structural splitting.
So this is not a local probe, right? It's sort of
this is a local probe.
Is it local?
Yeah.
So for a single atom, literally you measure this line or?
No, it averages over an ensemble of atoms.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right. So it's not, in that sense, it's not local. You wouldn't know where this
goes. It's local, but we are observing a summation of everything.
Right, but from this data, you wouldn't know where the holes are, right, for example.
No.
So I'm sorry, just so that I understand, the A line is from, the B line is from the coppers which are above and below.
About
the doping. Well, it's symmetrical, right? Isn't it? Oh, no, it's closer to one. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Sorry. Yeah. Right. So it's from the coppers which are close in the axial direction.
For instance, if we dope, for instance, European into the blossoms,
right,
then we observe one more line of lower frequency. So
because that has the opposite charge, you're saying?
It's the same charge, but probably it buckles and affect apical oxygen, something like that. No one really knows exactly what's happening.
Okay. And the intensities and so on make this extra feature are consistent with this picture?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Regardless of the temperature and concentration, this is always proportional to x. Now, so the importance of lattice effect is evident also in this temperature dependence. Actually, I have been showing this here for almost 10 years, maybe since 1993. So the peak frequency, probably as a function of temperature, show kink. Because what's happening is this kink temperature corresponds to structure phase transition. So what happens is copper site, each copper site is surrounded by roughly cubic symmetry Lansam sites, 8 of them. So electrical gradient from those sites happen to cancel out. But when there's structure phase transition from HTT phase to LTO phase, that cancellation disappears. So because of that increase of that contribution, quadruple resonance frequency begins to increase. And of course, the change is it's very difficult to see it here. But here is for Lansam 2.4, it's almost like a step function like change, very sharp change. But that's not just information you can get. If you plot the peak frequency, this is old work carried out with my friend in Japan in early 1990s. The peak frequency systematically changes with doping concentration, core concentration. Because after all, if you create charge, if you have vacancy in dx square minus y square root, that creates field gradient, and because of that, this increases. And B side also shows a slight change, but if you use barium instead of strontium, frequency is somewhat different, but again, it's basically the same behavior.
Is it clear why the B and A peak merge together at high doping?
Well, actually, maybe I shouldn't have shown this part. This is extremely disorder sample.
Okay.
So the line is very broad.
Yeah.
And they just fit into two Gaussians, and that's how they separate. Now, so back to this here again. You can see that there's tremendous line broadening, which basically implies that there's disorder in the system. Now, in passing, Lansam 2.4.4 is the cleanest system I know. This is only like 20 kilohertz wheels. This is about the same wheels as like Q plus oxide, kappa 2.0, non-magnetic Q plus oxide. But if you go to like YDCL7, the line is somewhat narrower than this red, but it's already high disorder. 1-2-4-8 compound about the same. If you go to like 60K phase, it has borders like this. So there is disorder, but it's not just charge disorder. This is something NMR community has been bothered for a long time. So the experiments carried out by my former collaborators in Japan, my alma mater, University of Tokyo, Professor Yasuoka's group. So they measured relaxation time, one of the P1 across the line. Then they found that there's very strong frequency dependence. So it's not just charge environment that's changing, modulating or whatever. But there's something else about spin channel too. And this has been bothering us for a long time. And I think I knew how to investigate this, but this was low, you know, priority. So we didn't initiate this until recently. The reason is they couldn't do a good job for this one. And actually their conclusion is, it's very funny, it's interesting. They concluded they have no idea why this happened. That's their conclusion. For us to get a good idea, we have to separate. So I showed only 63 couple line, but in reality, 63 couple line shows up like this. But 65 couple isotope or B1 shows up over here. And I'm sorry, this is 0. 63, this is 63, this is 65 B1, and then 63. And so 65L. So everything is superposed across the line, so it's very difficult to do the job. So to avoid that, you have to go with isotope enrichment, which is expensive. This here is particularly difficult for us because I'm sharing NSF master grant with a gentleman sitting here, and he cut my budget by $5,000. So it was a tough decision to make, but we decided to go ahead. That's the message.
Let's see. Everything you said is recorded.
Let's see. Yes, I understand. Before presenting the result, let me show you this cartoon picture. So the underlying assumption of the physics of high DC, avoid high DC is if you do holes, they are homogeneous. So even though light shape looks disordered, as long as hole concentration is effectively homogeneous, then there's no reason for us to expect variation 1 over T1, because 1 over T1 is spin relaxation time. So something is inhomogeneous, and the reason is why, the question is why. Now, my student did very simple calculations. Instead of saying holes are donated evenly across coupled line, let's assume that there's a length scale. And effective hole concentration, or equivalently, effective stretching concentration in a certain patch, because of statistical reason, can vary. So if you assume infinitely large coupled point take average, then distribution should be delta function if you have 15.5% of the sample. But instead, if you have to confine a certain domain with large size of, say, 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 3, patch by patch, because of statistical reasons, there's always distribution in stretching concentration. And imagine that because of that, in that patch of the couple to point, whole concentration is different patch by patch. So roughly speaking, as you might recall, quotable resonance frequency is roughly in proportion to x. So in this plot, the horizontal scale is x, but basically this corresponds to frequency. So if we believe that there's length scale of 0 of 100 lattices, that's a length scale that dominates, determines a couple to climb the lightning state. Then on the left-hand side of the magnitude spectrum of 11.5% of sample, is more or less like 7% of sample. In general, on the higher frequency side, may look more or less like 16% of sample. Now, so the top panel is just 11.5%.
Just to get it right. I guess the letter size really means the number of sites involved is not linear dimension. Then the 2 means a patch of 10 times 10, or does it mean it's 100 long? It's letter size, I'm just wondering. That is our
survey. Well, so we just calculate the simple probability.
No, the question is 10 to the 2 the number of points or the length
of
the
points.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's like 6 or 7 lines spaces. 6 times pi is 100.
But it might be stupidity, but it occurs to me that you have to make some kind of assumption about. So you said that there are patches, and these patches have different charge densities, right?
So all we are doing is think about a patch we say under lowest points, each site can have such ion with say 11.5% probability. And then come just randomly put such ion with 11.5% probability and ask how many such ion should be there.
Yeah.
Now, if we repeat similar calculations for these 100 sites, then this is the distribution we expect, just entirely by simple statistical distribution. Now, the amazing thing is, this roughly reproduces the experimental result, including the asymmetry of the line shape for 2% of the sample. Of course, in our model, last time took up what has to be data function. And peak frequency and width asymmetry roughly reproduce. So if we look at this MK line shape, we might speculate that when we say this is 11.5% of sample, but it may be statistically averaged over like 7% of sample, 10% of sample, 30% of sample, 15%. The question is, how do we justify it? Is this just my imagination? And the other way to address this issue, and that's where that one of the T1 measurement has a function of frequency. So they have no idea, but we realize we can use this.
Excuse me, what was the assumption for the probability distribution of those?
Oh, so we are just assuming random.
Just Poissonian process, you sort of drop it randomly and
So I think, strictly speaking, such ions probably won't avoid each other. So entire randomness may not be fair assumption, but it basically works.
But that's you did this simple assumption, and that's the result.
Yeah.
But this would give you a uniform distribution of strontium. I'm still confused.
Well, if you take huge lattice size, there it's 11.5%, and it's uniform.
Right.
Yeah. But if you look at just small space, suppose you look at just one atom. If you look at just one atom, then this 11.5% strontium is there.
Yes.
With 88.5% lattice is there. So that's extreme limit.
But then the size over which you're averaging, it's not really a domain of any kind, it's just how many actually the radius over which individual copper atoms actually sensing the whole density.
Yeah.
So he assumes that the density of holes is homogeneous on that size, right? And the density is calculated by this random
problem. Oh, it seems to me that it's like he, that's just consider an infinite plane and throw in the strontium randomly, right? Yeah. So we have homogeneous density, but then it's just if you choose any
it never is homogeneous because statistically there is always random variation. So we have this, it's a way of thinking. We have been saying for 10 years it's always random and completely homogeneous. But that statement is statistically true if the size is infinite. If you confine your picture into small domains, there is always variation position by position in coupled to point. It's just simple statistical.
Basically, sort of a very simple mesoscopic fluctuation in the sense that you're saying you take a small patch, you throw in as a Gaussian distribution impurities, then you insist on charge neutrality, so the number of electrons or holes going in is the same as the number of impurities. Right, from that, and then you patch up your whole space.
The assumption is that the holes are localized on the scale.
Yeah.
They're not extended.
Yeah.
There's some quasi-static.
Yeah, we can debate about the implications, so let me finish explaining that.
That's the assumption.
Now, so we measured relaxation time at the peak of these two samples. Actually, we are working on other concentrations too, and also half intensity. So if 11.5% has like more or less like 7% on each side or 16% on each side, relaxation time measured at these different frequencies should show different temperature difference. And that's exactly what we found. Now, this dash line is from my old data from Illinois. 0% of maximum 2.4, 2%, 4%, 6% I borrowed from my alma mater, University of Tokyo, 7.5, Somehow 11.5 is missing, but this is 15%. Now red is, so three of them, this corresponds to lower frequency side, this is a central frequency, and this is the higher frequency side. For blue, there are three of them, so lower frequency, center, and higher frequency, lower frequency, center, and higher frequency.
But these are not homogeneous either. These samples are not homogeneous either.
Yeah, so there is intrinsic distribution. Can I finish this?
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, first, let's look at the 11.5 just a little bit. The peak behaves as the conventional way we were thinking. The peak is basically showing the 11.5% behavior we presume. But that 11.5% of sample, if you measure T1 at a different spot, one of the T1 shows this behavior, which shows roughly the same behavior as the peak position of 7% of the sample. So there are probability in 11.5% of sample, there is a highest probability of observing this behavior is most likely, but this behavior is also happening, and this is also happening, like 15%.
So the curves that are on top of one another, are they the same frequency?
Roughly the same, but it's not exactly the same. Because there is intrinsic disorder effect from throwing into 2 plus ion and so forth. So it needs not be one-on-one correspondence. Basically, the line shape is convolution of intrinsic line width from lattice effect convoluted with whole concentration effect. So it needs not be one-on-one. But anyway, if we look at instead 7% of sample, higher frequency side, which is close to the peak of 11.5%, that shows behavior similar to 11.5% of sample. So experimentally, there's no way to deny the presence of weird inhomogeneity. If you take one sample, which is considered homogeneous with the 11.5% of sample, but some segments behave like having higher whole concentration, some other segments behave with, at least they're lower whole concentration. And so our claim is, if we make very simple objects, which high school students can understand, and just put randomness into it, then we can roughly reproduce. I'm not saying that's the only way of understanding it, but I think that's a starting point.
This seems very consistent to the SDM results of Schumann-Pinn, where he sees these inhomogeneities in real space, right? Mm-hmm. We are working on other systems too.
I'm sorry, so the old data were taken from the center of the line?
Yeah.
Okay, that was one.
Simply because it's easiest because sigma is big. That's why nobody really wanted to measure temperature dependence of T1 at different frequencies. Yeah. Anti Fujiyama somehow managed to do it in 100K. But fortunately, they have no idea what's happening.
All right, not being in high school, I think I missed something. So are you able to extract a length that gives the right distribution?
We can't say with very high accuracy, but it's clear that it's not as small as like Sally Lattice. Then a line should be as broad as like this, right. And half intensity position should be as well as like 5% of the sample. But that's not the case. So it's not as small as 30, but it's not as big as 1,000. It's on the order of 100, 200, 300.
Okay, and is that consistent with the expected range of interaction between?
Well, actually, that's why I want to get communication with theorists here. What kind of length scale is this? Is this just localization length, or screening length, or spin-spin correlation length? What is that? But we can talk about it. This was supposed to be 10 minutes, but. I spent too much time. Now let me switch my gear. So now I want to talk with so-called straight phase, where people believe that it's really inhomogeneous and perhaps even periodic. But let me give you our experimental conclusion first. As I said, at low temperatures, at NMR time scales, we don't see periodic modulation. I'm not saying there's no modulation, there has to be modulation, but it's just time scale. If we look at very slow time scale, everything is averaged out. Now, so this is a familiar A line and B line for 1S doping. The reason we work on barium dope sample instead of neodymium is neodymium has big moment, and it complicates everything, especially relaxation time measurement. So we work mostly on barium and europium dope samples, but they are believed to be basically the same. Most of the experimental results available are almost identical between those three systems. And this happens to be barium sample. So A line, B line stays there from high temperature to about 65 K. If we charge over a set sample, as you need those sample. Then all that we see is intensity just drops. So an integrated intensity drops your charge over in temperature, and it goes to essentially zero. But then if you further cool the sample, eventually the signal comes back. But the peak frequency is shifted lower, and also we don't even see V line anymore, and we lose like 10 times more. So the first goal is to understand this behavior from the base temperature. Now, I don't have time to go into the details, but based on similar measurement for Langstrom site, we can tell that hyperfine magnetic field in spin-frozen state is pointing in AB point. We just measure three different transitions and analyzing the result, we can tell it's within AB point. So let's plot the expected quadruple resonance frequency of the function of population, hyperfine field within AB point. So if there is no magnetic field, we should see one NQL transition here, which corresponds to A line. But there is, of course, B line, which corresponds to here. I'm not showing it here. But if you apply part of the system with in-point hyperfine field, you expect to see line splitting. If you go to Langstrom 2 couple for low temperature in any other state, you observe these three conditions. And if there is well-defined hyperfine field, you are expecting to see several transitions. But that's not what we saw. On the other hand, NIRSA, which is at somewhat faster time scale, we have to apply two other pulses to detect spin echo. Our time scale happens to be about 20 microseconds. NIRSA people can see spin oscillation of NIRSA density, I mean precession, which is proportional to the local hyperfine field. It contains about 0.5 microseconds. So with 0.5 microsecond time scale, there is well-defined hyperfine field. And they analyzed this oscillation. They concluded that basically this spin density wave state whose hyperfine field distribution should look like, so this is the distribution of hyperfine field. Because of sinusoidal modulation, it should show something like this, this density state. And they can fit their result nicely with this. It is about 0.3 mu V as a maximum of spin density. So, but we don't see this. In fact, if we assume 0.3 mu V spin density wave state like this, this is the one shift we expect to see. It doesn't look like the experimental result. The same statement is true for the simplest slight model initially used by Trunkhauser, but G's are also consistent. But none of G's reproduce single line peak at particular frequency. So this confused us a long time, actually. This line shape was first observed in 1992 by a Japanese group. But nobody.
To get an idea, right? Mu's are sitting at 20 microseconds?
0.5 microseconds.
0.5, and NQR is sitting at what
frequency? We need to have 20 microseconds.
So yeah, okay.
So if things are moving around during that time,
yeah,
there is motional average in it,
equal
to zero. So this is the same figure again. If you have 0.3 mu V sharply defined, then this is the distribution of hyperfine field, and this blue is expected line shape by reference data. But let's reduce the hyperfine field. Then we can introduce. What's happening is, it's a very simple story. Let's see, here we go. The peak frequency shown here corresponds to the frequency of this valley. Exactly the same. So if you have distribution hyperfine field starting from here up to like this back match, then you have lots of pileup of states. And that's what the peak is. So as long as you distribute hyperfine field at small magnitude like this, then we can reproduce this line. Also, there's one more catch. We have A line and B line. And turns out that it's very difficult to eliminate B line in simulated line shape. And we have to broaden both A line and B line quadruple resonance frequency, which means we have to have charging homogeneity. So unless we assume charging homogeneity, which causes part of a golden egg falls by like 5 to 3 or so. Otherwise, we always have B1 around here. So within the modal, we need to have charging homogeneity too. But nevertheless, hyperfermion field is much smaller than observed by near cell. That's what our conclusion is.
I'm sorry, just so I understand, you mean the same charge inhomogeneity that you discussed in the first part of the talk?
No.
For example? Or you mean that the strike order is not?
We just phenomenologically distributed this starting point. So this peak frequency corresponds to that particular 3.5% or something. But we are assuming that they have there's distribution here.
Right, but I guess my question is, what is the physical origin of this distribution basically the same as what you talked about in the first part of your talk, that is to say, random fluctuations in the strontium and so on, or is it an effect of having not perfect strike order or something like that?
That's a very good point.
Okay, so that's an open question at this point.
It may be exactly the reason why you have this.
Okay. Yeah, and also, I'm sorry, did I have an attack of narcolepsy? Where did the 20 microsecond timescale come from?
Also, it's experimental reason. We apply 90 degree pulse, wait 10 microseconds, then apply one more pulse, and then 10 microseconds later, we finally observe the signal. So everything that modulates during the 20 microsecond period affects the line.
So, but the fact, therefore, that you see a signal says that the times are of order 20 microseconds or longer, or is the statement that you see so much motional narrowing that fluctuations are short on that scale?
Well, at least motional narrowing effect time scale is comparable or shorter than 20 microseconds. But from here, so it's longer than 0.5 microseconds.
Okay, so you see a motionally narrowed signal, so therefore the window is between 0.5 and 20, right. Somewhere. Thank
That's
you.
True.
Okay.
That's right. Oh, by the way, one more thing.
Can you vary the echo time?
Well, 20 is sort of
the minimum. And I guess this timescale is consistent with the remaining wipeout. You can also estimate some timescale from the wipeout, right?
Yeah,
I will
come back to
that.
But you still see them residual moment, right? So you're saying that some are fast and some are slow?
I don't know
how. Catching the slow one?
All we can say is this distribution extending from 0 to like 3 Tesla. That's all we can say.
But
how it's distributed, I can't tell.
But that 0.15 is a moment which is static on the time scale of your experiment, or is fluctuating and motionally narrow?
Let's see. Average time. After motion averaging, so it may be 0.3, but because of meandering or spin, average may be 0.15.
Okay, right.
Now the next is wipeout. So the intensity loss, that's the next topic. Now, as I said at the August conference, this is not actually the first time we saw the signal loss. I saw it in 1990 in a paper which almost nobody paid attention. So in my thesis work with Professor Asoka, what we found was when the distributors APTA in 204 compounds, and actually we later found it the same basically similar in 1232 in the NOI. When this happens, it tends to show some weird wipeout effect. But at that time, we couldn't do a good job, primarily because of technical reasons. And also, if you deplete oxygen from optimum 204 compounds, then again, signal loss occurs, for instance. Let's see, for 0.15, there are three samples shown here. Nitrogen and oxygen is like 3.98 instead of 4.02. And signal intensity drops to zero. And for that kind of sample, relaxation time of one sample goes down at low temperature. So this is magnetism involved. So what we speculated at the time was, if you have holes localized, that region may behave more or less like spinless phase. So you know that temperature, relaxation time becomes too fast, and then we cannot see the signal. But what we didn't know was this was before the discovery of strike, so we didn't know any connection with strike. So our contribution from MIT is basically this anomaly exists everywhere below about 12.5% doping in radio 214 compounds. And this behavior takes place in the sharpest way and the most clearly defining way for the line space, where a spin density oscillation is the most well defined. Now, so back to the MIT story. So for any one stop sample where people do believe that there is no doubt that there is a charge density wave, volume, and you're looking on the limital sample. Intensity loss takes place basically the same way as the signal comes back. This back-up signal responds to the high golden signal. But intensity loss always start at charge ordering temperature. And in fact, if you plot square root of the intensity of charge order P, which in a conventional sense is charge order pioneer, temperature dependence of white dark fraction shown by red, the same result as this red, just flipped over, upside down, that shows the same temperature dependence of charge order pioneer. So experimentally, there has to be some correlation in the point. But that's not only for 1-8 space. If we work on other concentrations of neodymium or europium, for example, like when concentration is higher than 12, there's always sharp loss of signal. White body fraction changes from 0 to basically 1, no signal observable. And this onset is very sharp. On the other hand, below 1-8, it's always pale. As it turned out, at the time we published this result, a charge order peak had been observed only for this 1-8 phase. And the onset agreed very well. Afterward, X-ray neutron scatterings have been conducted. It turned out that for like 15 or 16% doping, this onset still agrees very well with diffraction peak of charge order. And also temperature dependence is roughly the same. On the other hand, below 12%, we claim that this is the onset of charge order, but we also caution that for us to get white body effect, we don't really need special correlation. As a matter of fact, in our 1990 work, we just speculated entirely from charge order. I'm sorry, vocalization, because charge order was not known yet. But the kind of that, so this tail part, it still does not have real, well-defined, especially modulating charge order. But we can see this kind of inflection point where Bill Fitch white body becomes very sharp. That turns out to be the long-range charge order temperature. In addition, we never published this until recently. Oh, by the way, I forgot to advertise this. My student has been writing this thick paper, which is 28 pages long at this point. It's a nightmare to help him to read this paper because it's so long. It takes like half a page to just read through. But read this. It will show up in archives soon. So finally, this data is going to be published. We have been showing this for almost 1 year. So, what about T1 of Langstrom size divided by the temperature, which is basically Q summation of chi double quine at NMR frequency. So it measures spin fluctuation. Now, at the onset of charge order, let's see, these arrows correspond to arrows shown here for European dose sample. And this inflection point is 20%. Below the temperature, a lot of TOP begins to show exponential blow up. In other words, once charge order sets in, spin fluctuation, low frequency spin fluctuation also kick in.
So, so, so to speak, because they take the black data, the normalized data, that's a spin ordering condition, right?
Well, we have to be careful. There's always distribution. So yeah. All we can say is at this temperature, spin fluctuation time scale, kappa spins become comparable to NQR with maximum probability. Yeah. Some other segment reaches the frequency at high temperature, low temperature.
So, I fully agree with Mr. Tatum, but it appears to me that at 20%, you actually don't see any, you know, significant slowing down of the spins in the sense that spin frequency also should be more frequency.
Down to this temperature.
Yeah. Okay.
There's correlation between charge anomaly and spin anomaly. As a matter of fact, charge order by scattering measurement has been observed only for the neodymium sample. And everybody has been assuming that volume and European do the same thing. So sometimes my friends have been picking on us, there's no charge, it's just spin. Now, so I have been begging to Professor Uchida and my friends at University of Tokyo to do more transport measurement. So as everybody knows, when you're dealing with sample, charge ordering temperature where scattering measurement detects long-range charge order and so on, I should say short-range charge order, then whole effect drops because charge motion becomes essentially one-dimensional, let's say, in gravitation. Now for European, nobody has done this, but finally, my friend Kojima-san did it. This is my courtesy of Dr. Kojima of University of Tokyo. So structure phase transition takes place at higher temperature, but it doesn't blow the charge or spin or anything. But one-dimensional arc behavior finally sets in at 70K. Same temperature as an adenine dope sample is 0.4 concentration. This happens to be 0.6. And also, that's where onset of Y values, that's where 1-watt T1 T1 begins to grow up exponential. All take place at the same temperature, which is chargeable. As a matter of fact, similar result, I knew this for this work from the beginning, but nobody is willing to quote apparently. Hall effect has been measured for Bahrain sample for, this is 1989 paper by Sato, Sera was his research associate at the time. So Hall effect also drops in this 1A space in Bahrain sample. And also below the temperature, susceptibility begins to show QE-wise like uptime, which means there's amperes being created below 65K. So again, there's something going on for charge channel, and also because of that, spin channel begins to fall.
Is there any signature of that in the diagonal resistivity? Just break
what do you mean diagonal resistivity?
Well, not the whole one, but just
railway
track. Yeah, road set. So you're saying that due to one dimension? Huh?
This is not my measurement, this is 1989.
Oh, so one of them is Hall and the other one is
this is resistivity.
Yeah.
Okay. Resistivity is known to be insensitive to strain. So let me summarize the experimental situation. So onset of Y part for New Guinea and European dose samples are shown by G symbols. And this is the inflection point. And blue are the charge overloading peak detected by neutron scattering. And now Hall effect also shows anomaly up here. Then red is spin order peak. And yellow is mu SL onset. Let's see what else. Other important ones. So this blue region is basically the coldest spot where zero field kappa NQL measurement shows the broaden line shape signal recovery. That's this blue region. Actually, there is a nice work by Teitelbaum and co-workers, which shows that intensity is biggest around here. In other words, in this region, you don't see freezing and spins at any other time scale. So this is also the white bar. And also shown here,
you're saying that the white bar says complete down to the lowest temperatures measured? Outside of the blue window, the white bar stays complete even at the lowest temperatures measured?
No. White bar is complete for any concentrations, but remember that at lowest temperature in 1S, the line blows because of frozen spins. Right. Therefore, signal intensity comes back. And that coming back signal is seen only in this blue region. So that's the coldest spot in the phase diagram. Now, the crosses are scaling analysis of resistivity by Uchida, Tankara, and co-workers. So they somehow set the temperature scale from resistivity measurement, and that's shown as crosses in this figure. So there's overall similarity in the concentration dependence. So our basic claim is, I will show more detailed analysis soon. So once charge anomaly sets in, especially about 12% doping, there is no doubt that long-range charge order, I mean short-range charge density modulation exists. And then spin magnetism kicks in, and then Wi-Fi starts, and then continuously slows down. But slowing down is fastest for 12%, and it's slower for 16%. On the other hand, below 12%, resistivity localization kicks in fast, which means and also, after all this concentration, we work the same crystal with the Trunker and the Chiris. Resistivity localization sets in, and also wipeout sets in, but charge order does not set in at this temperature. So, what's happening totally is, at the beginning, one hole localizes. That segment doesn't show up in the signal. Another hole localizes, and it eliminates some signal. But with decreasing temperature, somehow, some short-range coercion kicks in, and that's what this temperature is.
So where would be the superconducting temperature solution?
Oh, actually, this is DC.
Uh-huh.
But it's controversial. It may not be really bad superconducting.
So according to this, the transport is showing localization also for the point two, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at point two, the charge localization happens before ordering. Mm-hmm. So there may not be any stripe order there.
Well, you know, it's scaring on us. The course is scaring on us. So I don't know how much of an budget they have.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand.
Well, I'm not claiming this cost is exactly the same as this one, it's really 10 kb higher or something like that. Because after all, it's DB anomaly is the raw behavior, and they're just defining a temperature scale based on scale analysis.
So at point two, is your charge wipeout, is your wipeout also broad or sharp?
It's broader than here. It's sharpest at 12%. If you normalize the wipeout curve by the onset temperature, it's sharpest at 12%.
So different phenomena may be happening that causes the same wipeout,
well,
depending on the
I even disagree with your very helpful kind of comment. So I even disagree with you about this part, from here to here.
Yeah.
Something weird. And I don't know what this is between the end. I come back to this point later, okay? Now, knowing that a lot of people will ask me about this anyway, I'm sure this. Our new star, Yang Li, who is coming to MIT and junior faculty in 7 months. I don't have to explain, everybody knows this.
Really? I think that's probably not correct.
What?
What's that?
So this is oxygen-doped 214 compounds. THC is about 42 K, spin density wave setting at the same temperature. Amines are normally for this case setting at the exactly same temperature. So above and below has claims that this is more or less like second order conventional phase transition. Now, if we do.
Is this 1/4 stage four thing?
Stage something, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Four. Yeah. Now here is the total intensity. Black is the same crystals they use, a part of it. So wipeout setting is similar way. Although below 42 K, I wouldn't trust anything in our data because it's superconducting crystal. So because of skin depth, we can't do the job. Now, at high temperatures, there is also wipeout effect. This is not because of the lactate effect. This is just because of oxygen motion. So this is where Chris Hummel discovered some time ago for lower oxygen drop system. Oxygen motion is average in whole concentration, but phase separation sets in. That's this temperature. So above that temperature, even for higher oxygen whole concentration, wipeout is taking place because of this motion effect. I don't know exactly how wipeout takes place, but there's clearly correlation. Okay, so experimentally, I think it's clear that something is happening across the whole concentration. The sharpest wipeout clearly correlates experimentally with charge overloading signature, but also we have to caution that, as we did in our papers, physiology data especially, below 1S, spatial correlation may not be established well. It may be better. So at 1S doping, I think it's okay to say that probably charge order is kicking in, even for later 2-1-4 compounds. But away from 1S doping, gradually the word order becomes inappropriate. Now, so let me explain how wipeout is taking place. I'm going to analyze the data. Now, the analysis of this actually eventually will give us better idea of how fluctuation is taking place. I'm going to deduce fluctuation timescale based on wipeout analysis. Now, so why does wipeout take place? So there are basically, we can imagine, two effects. Unfortunately, majority of people read just this part and jumped up and didn't read this part, I guess. But there are two important effects. Number one is what is now known as direct mechanism named by Trunkler. So if charge is moving very fast, then we expect to see just one elliptical line, although there is some weird distribution as I showed earlier. But essentially, you have one well-defined resonance. But if charge motion becomes slowed down, eventually the line may not be well defined, because if you have charge density modulation, then quadruple frequency also disappears. But at the same time, if time of fluctuation slows down, crosses NMR timescale, then your acceleration time should also become very fast, quadruple your acceleration. So because of this charge effect alone, we can expect some wipeout. Although that's not proved, I mean, nobody knows how much this direct mechanism affects wipeout effect. But that's not really essential, because there's one more important thing, as we explained, this is now known as indirect mechanism. Namely, charge order turns on low frequency spin fluctuations. And the paper we quoted is Trunkard's paper. And I didn't even expect that this part will become a point of dispute, because I thought everybody expected this, and after their experimental result, evidence for this. So once charge order sets in, I think almost everybody expect spins begin to behave in a weird way. So your acceleration time should diverge, but if your acceleration time becomes too short, we are not able to detect signal. In fact, divergence of relaxation rate, as evidence, this is also copied from our PML paper. For a lot of them, relaxation rate measurement carried out extensively by both of them since early 90s, not everybody knows it goes up exponentially. So, probably these two components both contribute. Now, experimentally, what we are doing is we apply RF pulse to nuclear spins and manipulate spins, and eventually we observe so-called spin echo signal as voltage induced by precession ionization. To do that, we apply 90 degree pulse and 180 degree pulse, and then after like 20 microseconds later, from here, we finalize the signal. But if relaxation time is too fast, namely, we are relying on the fact that nuclear spins, nuclear magnetization, flip this way, stays in AB point for some time, and then manipulate again, but it still stays in AB point, and finally they emerge as spin echo. But if relaxation time is too fast, suppose relaxation time is say 1 microsecond for the sake of argument, 1/10 of this separation, then before second pulse arrives, this magnetization would flip back. Then we wouldn't see any signal. So if the relaxation time becomes too short, we get wipeout effect. Now, how important is that in Q-plate? It is very important. The bottom line is, kappa emission signal has been observed for 2 or 4, including ANDOF sample from our work in Illinois. But all the kappa signals are on the larger wipeout in 2 or 4. One of the T1 is, roughly speaking, inversely proportional to the energy scale of spin interaction. In other words, this is roughly, the order of magnitude is set by J. That's why basically a lot of material is the same value. But in step order phase, Trunkhardt deduced, based on the normal classical fitting, he claims that spin stiffness is of the order of 200. So imagine spin stiffness changes from about 1500 to 200. What's going to happen is, everything, concentration depends on what T1 is enhanced by factor 5 immediately. Perhaps followed by exponential divergence because of the normalized classical field. So if charge order sets in, and in certain domain, spin interaction energy scale is renormalized to somewhat smaller value, then we would expect immediate wipeout signal. Because all we need is just factor 2 or 3 enhancement in relaxation time. On the other hand, relaxation time is known to grow by 5 orders of magnitude between 60K and helium temperature based on last condition. So, charge order sets in here, and relaxation time in that charge order segment begins to grow up exponentially and equals 5 orders of magnitude. And it crosses this detection limit, which is around here. If relaxation time is relaxation rate is bigger than this, we can't see signal. And that takes place almost immediately once charge order sets in. So that terminological explains why wipeout effect correlates very well with charge order. Now, we can also estimate spin stiffness based on our measurement. Actually, Yan and his co-workers are working on a similar subject. So, let this kappa T1 in European gold sample. I don't like this screen, I capture everything at once. So European 0.2, something 0.12. So kappa shows, this is log scale, I should show this linear scale first. Kappa 1 over T1 shows unsuspecting behavior, this normal high DC behavior, 1 over P1 goes down towards transoverline temperature. Basically, this is the temperature range where on this MMP analysis works, or where neutron dipoles have omega over this gain. It's just canonical parametric fluctuation behavior of high DC down to this temperature. But below this temperature, CNI intensity drops very quickly. In that temperature range, 1 over TN Lanson begins to blow up. Okay? But unfortunately, Lanson, hyperfine coupling is so small for Lanson side. Lanson picks up all the garbage, like lattice fluctuations, structure phase tension, everything. So that effect dominates around this temperature. But as soon as charge overlap is hit, this begins to blow up. Now, what we are showing here is Lanson 1 over P1 multiplied by the square of hyperfine coupling of copper side on Lanson side. So effectively, what we are showing here is sort of bulk average of copper spin 1 over P1 measured through Lanson side. So down to this temperature, copper is the effective flow because we can see 100% of the signal, but signal begins to disappear, but Lanson doesn't disappear, so Lanson effectively pulls it. So we should look at this behavior first, and then below that temperature, we should look at this. So what I'm saying is, down to charge overlapping temperature, relaxation time goes, relaxation time goes this way. So nothing happens, it doesn't blow up or anything. That's why NMR community missed straight anomaly for 10 years. I published several papers working on this Wise concentration. I never realized, I must confess. Actually, my student is accusing me to 10 years for it to develop. It's so stupid. So that's what my students are telling me. Now, so one of the people doesn't do anything down to here. And then a charge order spins begin to blow up. So copper 100% follows this behavior, but some segments, when signal is lost, some segments are basically switching over to this exponential divergent behavior. And as soon as that happens, remember this is log scale, and our detectability limit is around here. So once crossover from here to here takes place for some segment of sample, we lose the signal. And also, this is a normalized classical effect. And turns out that 200 K works quite well. That's the temperature 2 pi OS deduced by Joe Trunker based on correlation lens. Let's get juice. Let's see. So, here's a summary of what I've been saying about the mechanism in the white lab. So, one obvious candidate is, and of course, more interesting possibility is so-called direct charge contribution. Slow charge dynamics, extreme line loading, fast cloud relaxation time. But we do know, actually we did know at the time of our paper, it had been known that in that temperature range, spin fluctuations are known to be enhanced dramatically followed by exponential behavior. So slow charge dynamics turns on slow spin dynamics, normalization of stiffness. Then in some segment, if spin stiffness is normalized, then we immediately lose a signal. And that segment begins to show exponential divergence of P1. But other segments still show canonical MMP type behavior, or omega over T type behavior. Now, so here is a summary of the experimental situation. I don't have time to explain the details, but actually there's a nice work by autonomous people who introduced the notion, concept of cutoff effect. I'll come back to that issue later, but thanks to that concept, we can now do a very quantitative analysis. So it turns out that basically the factor C enhancement I said, that can be converted to spin fluctuation frequency of gamma of 0 to 10 to 12. So at high temperatures, all the copper spins are forming this omega over this scaling behavior. Linear slowing of gamma, but right around the charge overlapping temperature, things begin to show anomalous slowing. Then neutron scattering begins to detect slow spin dynamics at slower time scale, 1 milli electron volt around here. And I don't have time to describe this, but last time, white hot, and also new SL starts anomaly around here. But eventually, things are settled down and become so slow that hyperfine field becomes essentially static, also not quite. So we begin to observe recovery of signal intensity, make response to G's based on time scale. So temperature dependence is known, so all we need to do is just assume some smooth change. These lines are plotted at every 12.5%, I think.
1, 2, 3.
No, 20%.
1, 2, 3.
Of every 12.5% probability. So if you cut across, say, at 30K, some segments still show omega over t behavior, but the signal is almost entirely gone. But everybody, I mean, Newton's scattering is already saturated, so all the spins are underneath this frequency. But some, but it's not quite slowed down to near cell frequency, around 30K near cell, finally beginning to see precession spins. So we can, by putting these distributions and just count the number of spins. So wipeout is 0% up to this temperature, but when you hit this temperature, half of the coupled spins have fluctuation times get slower than this wipeout, I mean, I'm sorry, this cutoff value. So signal is 50% gone at this temperature. And so on and so forth, so we can reproduce this temperature dependence. So basically, this is experimentally determined fluctuation timescale of the so-called state phase. Now, there's one caveat. In order to set these cutoff timescales, we have to assume Lorentzian dynamics, Lorentz oscillator model. But that may not be quite right. And actually, that becomes essential if we try to understand the fact that Zeeman part of the energy signal still has motion anomaly in there. So it cannot be this slow, actually. If we trust this, all the copper spins, electron spins have fluctuation frequency slower than 10 microseconds. So we would expect some well-defined peaks, but we don't see. So if we switch over, for instance, to Gaussian dynamics instead of Lorentzian dynamics, it turns out that these curves bend around here on such rate. I don't know why my speaker didn't do that here. In the next few lectures, I can show you. So probably Lorentzian speed dynamics is not quite like at low temperatures.
I mean, there is a suggestion that even at the absolute zero temperature, there would still be a finite spin fluctuation frequency. Is that to be taken literal, or is that
As a matter of fact, correlation lines never diverges, so there has to be some linear fluctuations.
Well, or there could just be a gap.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Well, but our experiment indicates there is fluctuation. Now, there's one more way of deducing spin fluctuation timescale. That is just analyze the nuclear spin equilibrium. So usually, when we observe a nuclear spin equilibrium, we fit to certain exponential equations or then theoretical quantum rate equations. So this, if you are able to fit this equilibrium at 65K by this dashed line, the timescale of this dashed line is 1 over T1. I'm sorry, T1 relaxation. A fit doesn't work in any of these samples, so we have to assume that there is a distribution. For instance, 65K, we need to have this much of distribution in T1, 350 mKelvin, this much of a distribution. So we can deduce the central value, most likely value of 1 over T1, and its distribution. And then, so 1 over T1, again, goes up, you don't charge all in temperature. But at the same time, in the temperature region, distribution of 1 over T1 begins to go up. Notice that this is on log scale. So, you know, at room temperature, suddenly this distribution begins. There is minimum, local minimum around here. I don't have time to go into details, but Yang already knows what this is. Basically, this is because of wipeout effect on the left-hand side. So, we are not really measuring bulk. We are not really probing the bulk average around the T1. We are picking up mostly nuclear spins whose T1 is relatively long, still observable. That's why there's this weird local minimum gap, local minimum. And this should be considered as essentially the lower bound. So on the other hand, at the lowest temperature, actually maybe you can see this shadow region. From here to here, there is wipeout effect on lanthanum, but below the temperature, here is now 100% zero. So we are probing the bulk, and in that case, distribution will show the 1,000. In other words, one of the key lines, roughly speaking, inversely proportional to spin fluctuation timescale of electron spin. So there is still a matter of distribution here, but there is not much distribution of charge over temperature. And so in this region from here to here, because of wipeout, we can't really do a good job. But this blue is the normal crosscut slowing, and these three curves are the same curve I showed in the previous picture, based on wipeout. So this is what you'd expect for Lorentzian dynamics, and this is Gaussian dynamics. So in the case of Gaussian, it will resolve. Now I'm trying to finish New York. It's a little bit over time. Just several more. So about the public's complaint, for varied concentration X, like 12, 16, 20, if we did the same analysis, we obtain quantitatively the same result. The only difference is everything is just pushed down toward lower temperatures. But in other region, something kicks in, but it's really mild, slowing down until the low temperatures. So actually, we can fit all this behavior. If you believe that this is more or less normal classical behavior, we can reduce this difference. And as I said earlier, about monostopy is about 200 Kelvin, but it's smaller on this side and also smaller on that side.
So you take it through the last just because everywhere below that curve?
It works. That doesn't prove. Now, I have to be very careful what I'm going to say. And there has been tremendous confusion in gene interpretation lifelong. I hope I have made experimental case that basically, experimentally, white blood correlates with charge anomaly. And by evaluating the concept of the cutoff, we could even deduce spin fluctuation time scale distribution. But there's several people, as you witnessed at the August conference, Los Alamos has been claiming, basically forget about charge degrees of freedom, it doesn't matter. That's basically what they're saying. Now, let me explain what they're doing. So what they do is, measure one of the kilon of Larson site and assume certain distribution. Namely, they assume that relaxation light follows this form. This is sort of DPP form. What they're doing is assume all Lorentzian dynamics and the real part follows QE behavior. That's what they're assuming. And then this one of the kilon is parameterized by correlation time, slowing of correlation time. And this correlation time distribution was fitted with activation energy of its distribution, so they are basically two parameters. So they want to fit everything within this scheme, so they fit one of the Kion Larson, as shown by this red, and set this EA on its distribution. So this is the main reason why it's set. Now, the next step is, although fit does not seem to be working quite well about Psi K, after all, as I said, at high temperatures, you don't think the same spin dynamics is taking place. But they assume that you can extrapolate this red curve to all the way up to the temperature. They extrapolate this all the way, okay? Then, they assume that, actually, it's not really an assumption. Since Larson is an effective probe of spin fluctuations of kappa psi, so they are mutually related just by proportionality constant. So by extrapolating the exponential temperature dependence, so this is the distribution of expected assumed form of one of the kappa psi. So there is like this much, 12.5% of kappa has one of the faster than this group have or more. 50% of kappa spins have one of the faster than this kappa or more. 100% above this curve. So there is 12.5%, every 12.5% distribution is shown. So by extrapolating their fit, this is what they are assuming for relaxation time of carbon. They're assuming that it's exponential all the way from room temperature to cabin temperature. That's what they assume. Assuming that, now this concept of carbon is really great. Without that concept, we couldn't do any quantitative analysis. So they somehow estimate cutoff, although I think their value is almost smaller than mine, you overestimated. But since they assume this behavior is correct, so if relaxation rate is faster than this, you can't see the signal. So then from high temperature, one of the things they need to blow up exponentially. And then some segments, 7.5% of the sample hits this cutoff, signal is wiped out. 50% of the signal has faster, Kion faster than this or higher, so 50% of the signal is wiped out here, so on and so forth. So that's how they plotted this kind of wipeout behavior. And this, it's the same result when you produce the calculation. So we know what they're doing. And based on this, they claim that, well, basically, MIT is wrong. Charge has nothing to do with this behavior. Everything is spin. Onset of wipeout has to be called spin freezing. But I must emphasize, their calculations are based on this assumption. They're assuming that charge is not doing anything. They just assume this exponential behavior all the way up to temperature. Although experimentally, this is their result. One of the key ones going down. What I am saying, what we are saying is, one of the T1 experimental is going down, but once charge order kicks in around 65K, behavior switches over from MMT behavior to exponential behavior. That's kind of why it matters. That's why if you emphasize the onset of wipeout as the underlying mechanism as slowing charge dynamics, you can call the onset of wipeout T charge or T walkout or whatever you name it. If you emphasize the consequence, namely, if charge slows down, spins should also slow down. So I wouldn't object calling it TSF, as long as you admit that you're talking about the same thing as ours. But, you know, the T charge and claim it's TSF, well, this is what they're doing. Oh, so one more thing. Now, you may think that after all, wipeout is to produce this may be reasonable, but that's not the case. How you extrapolate this behavior at low temperatures doesn't matter for the calculations of this wipeout. So they decided to extrapolate underneath this curve by the same exponential form, but you can extrapolate by this curve or this new curve or whatever you do. As long as this extrapolated behavior at higher temperature, whatever QM behavior is below this curve, you always get the same result. In other words, they never fitted anything above 30K. Their fit is working only in 30K. Now this is the final part. I'm sorry I'm going a little too long. This is the final part. Now what's about 214? Now this is a summary of what we have seen so far. Blue field circles are wipeout onset for regular 214. Open circle also is the onset, but the volume fluctuation is less than half. But in the diagonal set regime, or equivalently in the insulating regime, rather than superconducting regime, wipeout onset somehow jumps to the ceramic Kelvin. We don't know what the hell going on. That's what experimentally we see. Now, about 1S, everybody can see kappa NK signal even at the base temperature. So there may be some remnant wipeout effect, but maybe down effect or distribution or concentration, who knows? So we are worried obviously by two things. Number one, what's really going on in this region? Number two, is this entire just from damp effect? If localization sets in, then wipeout can take place. So at the time we published our PRL, we still didn't know that there is diagonal strike order in the base temperature. Or even in this region, there might be total collaboration from spin freezing, strike freezing in this temperature. So now everybody knows strike is there and here. But at the time we published about the wipeout effect, we didn't know. So we were worried a lot about this. Maybe it's just junk effect. So we decided to go zinc. Zinc can do several things. Resistivity can be enhanced. So if it's just junk effect, maybe wipeout is also enhanced in temperature. And also, zinc doping can enhance strike freezing. And 15% range, if you don't drink, according to my friend Hilton, you can see spin freezing. But on the other hand, at the canonical 1S doping, drink doping suppresses strike. So it's interesting to see what's going to happen. So we measured wipeout effect.
Actually, can't we?
Yeah, just one more. I'm going to finish. I'm sorry. So 11.5. Wipeout is suppressed, as expected from neutron. But in superconducting samples, we do see very sharp wipeout. Although in superconducting samples, this is probably just because of wipeout, spurious wipeout because of superconducting shielding. But with doping, zinc doping and superconductivity suppressed, we can see sharp wipeout. But at 7%, all over that region where we thought maybe jump effect is causing. We threw in a lot of zinc and enhancement theory by factor 2 and the temperature of the organization much higher, and nothing happens. So this is what we have found. So thank you very much for your attention.